Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So here we go with the Kausambhya Sutta. Now this particular sutta is about harmony and also about the practice which we have, a spiritual life which we have, even though it mentions mostly bhikkhus, which is the word for monks, and nuns, it just applies to anybody who is committing themselves to practicing a spiritual life. In particular, the background to the story is that even in the time of the Buddha, sometimes that some monks, not being all that enlightened, got into arguments. And the particular argument they got into was one day that somebody went to the toilet and they didn't fill the water jar up after they had left. And because of that, there was a big argument. He said, you should have done. No, you shouldn't, because there was no water outside. And on just a small matter like that, which is what happens in life, a small little disagreement soon blew up out of all proportions, and people started taking sides on who was right and who was wrong. And as they say, that sometimes over small matters they have these big arguments. I don't know if ever any one of you, when you were young, there was an English book by Jonathan Swift called Gulliver's Travels. And there he went to a little place which was at war. And what they were at war at was, when you eat a boiled egg, which side of the egg should you start from? The sharp end or the more blunt end? And because of that, they had a war which had claimed many lives and which had been going on for centuries. It was a satire to show just how the small differences of opinions, great wars can be fought. And even just in real life, I remember just as a schoolboy that one of the wars, again, which claimed many lives between England and Spain, was literally called and known for all humanity as the War of Jenkins' Ear. Do you know what the War of Jenkins' Ear was? I think it went on for 100 years. It was also known as the 100 Years' War, because the British, or the English, sent an ambassador to the court of Spain called Mr. Jenkins. And they didn't like him very much, so they cut off his ear and sent that back to Queen Elizabeth I. And that was too much to see her ambassador's ear arrive back in the mail, and so she declared war on Spain. So, okay, it's not a nice thing to cut off somebody's ear, but to kill many, many people just because of that is a bit of an overreaction. But anyhow, in this particular case, so the monks never went to war, they started arguing. And having had that argument, when the word came around that the monks were misbehaving because they were arguing with each other, the Buddha went to go and visit to try and settle the matter. But as soon as the Buddha came, they said, you go off and meditate, we'll sort this out by ourselves. Which also shows that when you really get into an argument, sometimes you lose all sense of what's proper and what's improper. And they even just showed complete disrespect to the Buddha. So what the Buddha did, if they weren't going to listen to him, he just decided to go off and stay by himself. So he went off to this forest, which now became known as Parilaya Forest. By the way, Kausambhi is around the modern-day city of Allahabad. And so that he went off to a forest called the Parilaya Forest. And there, staying alone in the Parilaya Forest, he was looked after by an elephant. Because you know that monks have to have their food offered, and sometimes you can have animals offering your food. And that's quite allowable. There was one monk, even when I was in Thailand in the early years, he had trained a little monkey. Somebody gave him a monkey who was being caught in a cage and was mistreated, and so very often they let the animals loose in the monastery. And this monk looked after that monkey and trained him. And that monkey, you could actually point to, say, a banana on the banana tree. And the monkey would climb up the banana tree, grab an apple, grab a banana, come down, and he would offer it to the monk and put his hands up or paws up like this afterwards. He was a very well-trained monkey. But when Ajahn Chah saw that, he said, they're going a bit too far. It was good fun to see. But it was allowable according to monastic rules. Animals can offer you things. So anyhow, this particular elephant looked after the Buddha for 3 whole months. And maybe you may have seen these very famous Buddha statues with the Buddha sitting there and a monkey on one side and an elephant on the other side. Because what happened next was the elephant was feeding the Buddha for the whole 3 months, you know, finding fruit from the jungle and just presenting it to the Buddha. And you know, if you meditate, you don't have to eat all that much. And a monkey saw this, and the monkey thought, wow, that's doing some good karma for this monk. He didn't realize it was a Buddha. Doing good karma. And so the monkey decided to get a piece of the action. He went through the forest and found a honeycomb. And then he came and offered the honeycomb to the Buddha. And the Buddha accepted the honeycomb. And after the Buddha accepted the honeycomb, he got instant karma, instant reward. He got so happy. He managed to offer something to a great being. He went swinging through the trees. And because he was swinging through the trees, he was so exhilarated, so happy, he lost his mindfulness, missed a branch, came crashing down to the ground and died. See, which is one you don't get too happy. And that's a wonderful thing to do, but he got too happy. It doesn't matter, because it all had a nice ending. Because he had just offered something to a Buddha, and he died with this beautiful thought in his mind, he got immediately reborn in quite a high heaven realm. So it had a happy end. The monkey had a very, very good rebirth in a high heaven realm because his mind was very pure at the time he died. As for the elephant, he kept on looking after the Buddha. Back in Kosambi, when the people realized, the Buddha came this morning, where's he gone this afternoon? And they found out he'd left because he was so fed up with his monks. They hadn't even listened to him. And when the lay community realized the Buddha had come and never even given them a talk because these monks had not listened to him, they thought, this is going too far. So they met together and they had a discussion. How can we teach these monks a lesson? And in those days it was very easy to teach the monks a lesson. They decided in the whole town that no one, not one person, would offer those monks anything to eat. So the next morning when the monks went on alms round, they got nothing. Sip. Zero. No one came to the monastery to bring them any food either. They went hungry. The same thing happened the next day. Because as monks, we can't store food. You're not supposed to have, you know, monks of our tradition, we don't have money. All monks aren't supposed to have money. In those days, they kept that rule strictly. And so they couldn't go out and buy anything. They went hungry. When it happened the next day too, no one fed them. They went hungry a second day. After 7 days of not getting anything to eat, they decided they'd better fix up their problem. And so they came together, both sides, they said, let's finish this argument, even for the sake of our stomachs. And so they met together and they forgave each other. That was the end of the argument. And once they told everyone, and they meant it, the argument was all over, then they started getting fed again. But in the meantime, they wondered, where's the Buddha gone? And so they sent a delegation to try and find the Buddha, led by the Buddha's attendant, Ananda. And eventually they tracked the Buddha down in this forest. They saw the Buddha there. And they told him that the Sangha had been reunited. The argument was over. They asked forgiveness. They were stupid and they shouldn't have done that. And as I often say in Buddhism, there's no punishment ever. As long as you acknowledge your fault, say, oh, I was stupid, I did a wrong thing, we'll try not to do that again. Then that's the end of the matter. So there was no punishment at all there. And so the Buddha said, okay, I better come back now. But when the elephant heard that, oh, I'm going to lose the Buddha. Because he'd been looking after him all by himself for 3 months. And obviously got to love the Buddha a lot. And so the Buddha said, well, one more meal for all the monks. And so the elephant just really busted a gut trying to get all this fruit from the forest to feed all these monks. And he gave them this great dana. And as soon as the Buddha left, the elephant died of a broken heart. He'd been looking after the Buddha for 3 whole months all by himself. And now the Buddha had left. He died of a broken heart. But because he had just made enormous good karma, he got reborn even in a higher realm than the monkey. And so he was fine. So that's a little story, wonderful story, about what happened at Koh Samui. It had a beautiful ending. Sure, they died, but they're going to die sometime. And the elephant and the monkey both got reborn in very, very high heaven realms because of what they did. And it also shows you what to do if the monks, even in this monastery over here, misbehave, don't feed us. We're very good monks, we don't have money, so we can't go and ring up and get a pizza delivery. So, if you don't feed us, we'll soon come to our senses. So that's what happened. And this is what happened a bit afterwards. Thus I have heard on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Koh Samui in Gosata's park, and when he was just visiting. On that occasion, the monks at Koh Samui had taken to quarrelling and brawling and were in deep disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. That's the idiom of the time. It's very obvious what it means. Because sometimes the barbs, the way we speak to each other, can go right in here, even sharper than a knife. They could neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. They could neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. That's what an argument is like. You know, you're not convinced, you can't convince others, so it keeps on going on. Then a certain monk went to the Blessed One, and the Blessed One is a Buddha, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and informed him of what was happening. The Blessed One addressed a certain bhikkhu thus, "Come, monk, tell those monks in my name that the teacher calls them." "Yes, venerable sir," he replied, and he went to those monks and told them, "The teacher calls the venerable ones." "Yes, friend," they replied, and they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side. And the Buddha then asked them, "Monks, is it true that you have taken to quarrelling and arguing and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, that you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others, that you can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others?" "Yes, venerable sir." "Monks, what do you think? When you take to quarrelling and arguing and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, do you on that occasion maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, of mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life?" "No, venerable sir." "So, monks, when you take to quarrelling and brawling, or quarrelling..." Have a brawling in this translation over there, but it literally means arguing, because the monks wouldn't fight. They wouldn't go that far. "So, monks, when you take to quarrelling and arguing and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, on that occasion, do you not maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life? Misguided men." I always use this phrase when he's telling somebody off. He never says, "You evil man." He says, "You're just misguided." It's a wonderful little term there. So we never actually call anybody sort of evil or bad. They're just misguided, that's all. Which shows that they can be re-guided in a good direction. So you never call, you know, your husband evil or your wife sort of stupid. You can say, "Misguided woman" or "Misguided man." Much more fun. And then you're a Buddhist. "Misguided men, what can you possibly know? What can you see that you take to quarrelling and arguing and are deep in dispute, stabbing each other with verbal daggers? That you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. That you can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. Misguided men, that would lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." So always actually brings out the cause and effect. If you act in a misguided way, it'll always lead to your harm and suffering and other people's as well. Then the Blessed One, the Buddha, addressed the monks thus, "Monks, there are six fit-to-be-remembered qualities that create love and respect and conduce to helpfulness, to non-dispute, to concord and to unity. What are these six?" Now this comes to the important part of the teaching here. So it means in any community, whether it's in your office, in your Buddhist society, in your family, or whatever group you have, these are the six things you should always remember, which create love, respect, helpfulness, non-dispute, concord, and unity. So if we have even like a committee of our Buddhist society, or if we have just, you know, a nun's monastery. Whatever we have, these six things are important so that we can always have harmony and well-being in any group of people. Number one, here the monk or the person maintains bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards their companions in the holy life. You can change that to your companions in the family, or companions in the office, or companions in the cricket team, or whatever. This is a memorable quality that creates love and respect and conduces to helpfulness, to non-dispute, to concord and harmony. Number two, you maintain verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life. This is the second memorable quality. Again, a monk maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards their companions in the holy life. This is a memorable quality that creates love, respect, and conduces to harmony and unity. Okay, that's the first three. So, physical, verbal, and mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private. So if you want harmony in your office, you have to do things which are kind and caring, not just when that person is around in public, but also behind their back as well, do acts of kindness, both physical acts of kindness and verbal acts of kindness, praise them, say nice things about them, and obviously even think kind words or kind things about them. That's how we have harmony. And certainly that's what I always remember from my teacher Ajahn Chah. If you're going to have a monastery with lots of people, you have to have those degrees of loving kindness. Always care for your monks. You know, look after them. And I don't mean just think about this. Do kind acts for them. I remember one monk, I just mentioned this earlier, a couple of days ago. There was one of the monks. He was saying how hard it was to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is when we had to get up in Thailand. And he said, oh, I wish I could, you know, have a cup of tea or something that time of the morning. And I said, okay, tomorrow morning I'll get you a cup of tea in bed. So I got up at 2:30, made a cup of tea for him, and just as the bell was ringing at 3 o'clock, I knocked on his door to give him a cup of tea in bed. That was Ajahn Manindo. Some of you may remember him. And of course, it's a silly thing to do, but because I did that, you're just making good friends and creates an enormous amount of harmony. When you do something a little silly, but still it's a nice thing to do, to give a monk a cup of tea in bed at 3 o'clock in the morning when he gets up. Actually, he wasn't in bed, he was just on the mat on his floor. So, little acts like that create harmony and well-being in the office, in the monastery, and also words, kind words. So you always go around trying to praise, you know, your partners there. In an office, if you're working together and someone does, you know, a bit extra, say thank you. Go over the top. Say just how much you appreciate that they've done so much. And those acts and words never underestimate their power. You can see here that Buddha is saying that these are how you can conduce to harmony and peace and well-being in any community, by doing acts of body, speech and mind in public and in private. Because it always gets around to them. If you go around, you know, telling your co-worker what a great person they are in their face, but then you go and tell someone else around the coffee machine, they're really lazy, they're no good. It gets around to them. Coffee machines have ears. They remember it and it goes to the next person who goes there. I don't know how it works. But I've been telling the monks, no matter what you say, never think that all our supporters don't know exactly what's going on in this monastery. I don't tell them. I don't know how they find out, but they know what's going on. Because there's great vibes and people talk about each other. So in your office, it doesn't matter. You think you're keeping a secret. Huh? You're not. Everybody knows. So it has to be in public and in private. Okay, so number four. And again, a monk uses things in common with his virtuous companions in the holy life. Without making reservations, he shares with them any gain of a kind that accords with the Dhamma and has been attained in a way that accords with the Dhamma, even including the contents of his bowl. So this is actually where we share. Now, obviously, because I'm the abbot, the senior monk, people give me heaps of things. But I don't just keep them all for myself. You know, you share them with others. And when you actually share everything you get in a monastery, even the lazy monks who don't do anything, they still get an equal share with everybody else, even the ones who work really hard. And that way, when we share things together, whoever gets something, we all share together. That is conducive of peace and harmony. So it's great when we do that. I believe, from what I was reading once in the newspapers, even the Australian cricket team do that. If, for example, somebody wins a Man of the Match award and they get sort of a new car or something, you know, they flog it or something and they share it with the whole people in the cricket team. You don't just say, "Wow, I deserved it, I've got it, it's mine." If they do that, they wouldn't have the sort of the harmony and the team spirit. So whoever actually wins, say the Man of the Match, always gets shared between everybody in the team. You can see the difference there? It means everybody is actually part of the team. So, even in your office, wouldn't it be wonderful if you get a raise, you share it with everyone else in your office? Could you do that? It'd be great if you could, because that means a lot of harmony and peace. I know the indigenous communities, whether the Aboriginal community here in Australia or other communities, they always tend to share things. If anyone has a windfall, they always share it with other people. Because it's family, it's group, it's us. So the Buddha was actually saying here, don't be just like in a community of monks. You're the rich monk and everyone else is poor, that you have all these things and no one else has anything. Which is, you know, why that sometimes that people ask if I need anything. The last time that someone asked me if I needed anything a few days ago, I said the monastery needs some shaving cream. Because, you know, we have to shave quite a lot, much more than you guys do. But I never use it. I just use soap. I've been shaving with soap for the last 30 years. Don't need shaving cream. No, there's shaving foam. That's only for namby-pamby cream puffs. But, but no, that's not true. But no, I said I've got to have... I've just broken, what was it, number two there? About in public and in private, words of loving kindness in public to your companions in your holy life. Oops, I blew it there. But no, the point being here is that, because I don't need that, but if someone asks what you need, I ask for that so the other monks can get it. So that's actually what you do to create peace and harmony. We share everything. And even if we haven't got any food, we always share whatever we get. That's a beautiful thing to have. Okay, and number five, again, a monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions. I've got making reservations, I should have that. So we don't reserve things for ourselves. You know, this is my food, this is my hut, this is my thing, and no one else can make use of it. So we do share everything, or anything you give to the monastery is always shared. I know that sometimes when there's an alms offering and people come up and they have like robes or something and they like to offer it to the senior monk, whoever that senior monk is, they don't have to worry about that because it all goes to all the monks. For those of you who are at our Katina ceremony, you see that people come and offer robes and other gifts. And it doesn't matter which monk you offer it to because it's shared with everybody. I don't have this store of robes. I'll get the best robe and I keep the best stuff for myself. It's all shared without any, whoever needs it, takes it. We don't keep the best. So that's without making reservations. Number five, a monk dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in a holy life those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmortal, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended and conducive to samadhi, concentration. This too is a memorable quality that creates love and respect. In other words, that one is a virtuous person. And there are certain virtues, he doesn't say exactly what it is, but he says the virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmortal, liberating, which are commended by the wise. So we all know what's commended by the wise people. You know, things like generosity, forgiveness, gentle speech, helping each other. Not being harmful by hitting each other or stealing. Those virtuous conduct, whatever is commended by the wise, what people realize is goodness, kindness. That's what we mean by virtue. And it was very skillful. The Buddha never actually said, don't do this and do that. Here he's actually saying, what you understand is commended by wise people, what virtue is. And so if in a group we have that degree of virtue, then that is also conducive to harmony. Because it is difficult when some person is like stealing, or say committing adultery, sleeping around with other people's partners. It's hard to have harmony when there are bad people, or rather misguided people in the midst. So when you are associating with virtuous people, that too is a memorable quality that creates love and respect and is conducive to helpfulness, non-dispute, concord and unity. So virtue is the cause for harmony and unity in our world. I think you all should know that. That if you want to have a harmonious office, then to encourage virtue in that office. If you want to have a harmonious Buddha society, then have virtuous people. If you want to have a harmonious world, have virtuous people in that world. Then harmony comes. It just makes people lovable. And it means it encourages helpfulness. And also, once again, the Buddha points here, just in passing, because such virtue is conducive to concentration, to samadhi, to meditation. This is a common theme. Here it's not stressed because we're focusing on something else, but it's a common theme throughout Buddhism that your virtuous conduct, just your goodness, is conducive to ease in meditation. So sometimes when people are having trouble meditating, I say, what is your virtue like? What are you doing after you finish the meditation retreat? Are you being a, not a naughty, not a bad person, but a misguided person? And lastly, a monk dwells both in public and private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life that view that is noble, emancipating, and leads one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. This too is a memorable quality that creates love and respect and conduces to helpfulness, to non-dispute, to concord and unity. In other words, when we have like a common view, then that also helps, like a common purpose, a common goal. We understand what that common goal really is. That also gives us an idea of unity. Which is why that, you know, when we have businesses, sometimes we want to have a mission statement. The whole purpose of having such a thing as a mission statement is just to make it quite clear what we're here for, what we're doing, what's the purpose. Which is why in a Buddhist society, you know, always remember, tell people, what's the purpose of having a Buddhist society? It's to be Buddhist. What's a committee? When I always mention the committee, I say we're Buddhist before we were a committee. So we don't think that we're a committee, we have to have an argue and get our own way. We're Buddhist first. And so when we understand what the purpose of like having a center like this is, and we keep that purpose in mind, we have a common view of what we're here for, then it's much easier to create harmony and helpfulness. And it's the same in a marriage. What have you got a marriage for? What's its purpose? It's not just so you can get the most out of it, and you can have your sex, and you can have, you know, someone washing your clothes or giving you money or whatever. And that's not the purpose. If you have an idea of what a marriage is, what a family is, what a society is, and you have that common view, then it's very easy to have harmony and peace. So we have like a common view, which is noble, emancipating, and leads one who practices in accordance with it complete destruction of suffering. That too is a memorable quality. So these are the six memorable qualities that create love and respect and conduce to helpfulness and to non-dispute and to concord and to unity. So especially, he was saying that to the monks, but what are you here for? You're not here to be the one who's right, you know, be the one who's got it right according to whether you should or shouldn't leave water in the receptacle at the toilet. Is that what you're a monk for? So when you have the right view there, it's very easy to actually say, ah, oh, it's a small thing, forget about it, and have unity and harmony, and to always have this kindness by body, speech, and mind, have virtue and to share things. And that way you'll find you'll always have peace and harmony and concord. Interesting when we look upon the disharmony in the world and also the wars and the conflicts, you look actually see these six memorable qualities. You know, say for example, like the Israel and Palestine. Now, look at these things. Are the Israelis and Palestinians maintaining verbal acts of loving kindness, mental acts of loving kindness, physical acts of loving kindness towards each other? Are they both virtuous? Are they sharing things like their wealth and resources? And have they got like the view, which is a common view? Actually, they have got a common view in the sense that they both want security and peace, you know, for their land. But when you have, you know, many of these other six memorable qualities, especially sharing, not being acted upon, of course there can never be unity and harmony. So the Buddha is actually making quite a strong social statement there. Whenever there's a lack of sharing of resources, there's always going to be some disunity and disharmony in the world. Any questions before we go further? Okay, but the Buddha continues. Of these six memorable qualities, the highest, the most comprehensive, the most inclusive in this view, that is this view that is noble and emancipating, and leads one who practices it in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering. Just as the highest and most comprehensive, the most conclusive part of a pinnacle building is the pinnacle itself. This is a type of building which was common in the time of the Buddha, where the roof, the rafters all met at a point, and that was the highest part of a building. He was just using a metaphor which was very easy to understand at that time. So too of these six memorable qualities, the highest is the view that is noble and emancipating. So obviously, when you get the view right, the right view, that is the most important. Everything comes from that. Why are we here? What are we doing here? If you get that right, then usually you can understand why we should maintain acts, words, thoughts of kindness, why we should share. We're not here to be the richest person, we're here to be happy people. And why we should be virtuous. Why should we be virtuous? Can't we just screw everybody else and get as much as we want? That's not what we're here for. You get the right view, then everything else falls into line. But here the Buddha is actually now pointing to the monks here, especially, the view for enlightenment itself. Because this is a view that is noble and emancipating, and leads one who practices in accordance to the complete destruction of suffering. So how you became enlightened, based on this emancipating view. So, any questions before we continue? Okay, off we go. Here, a monk or a practitioner has gone to the forest or to the root of a tree, to an empty place. It shouldn't be empty heart, it's empty place. Considers thus. In other words, you're starting to meditate, practice. Is there any obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind that I cannot know or see things as they actually are? If a monk is obsessed by sensual lust, then his mind is obsessed. If he's obsessed by ill will, his mind is obsessed. If he's obsessed by sloth and torpor, his mind is obsessed. If he's obsessed by restlessness and remorse, his mind is obsessed. If he's obsessed by doubt, then his mind is obsessed. I'll stop there for a minute. Those five things, what are they called? The five hindrances, yes. So actually, that's one of the first things you should do when you're practicing. Am I obsessed by any one of those five hindrances? They're the big enemies in Buddhism, because why do you have those five hindrances? As they say, that you cannot know or see things as they actually are. Now, often we think we know, we see, but when we have those hindrances, we don't see what's really there. The first one, if it's like sensual lust, it doesn't mean like sexual lust, it means just desire, what you want. Which means, if you really, really go into that shop, into Myers, and see this amazing dress which you can't afford, if you want it so much, you don't see things as they really are, you've got no credit left on your credit card, you buy it nevertheless. And you get into big trouble afterwards. You don't see things as they truly are. Or even like a man, sometimes they do have sexual lust, and they go crazy. They don't know what they're doing, literally. And sometimes, and I've mentioned this to quite a few people, they think that they will never get found out. They have an affair. Complete craziness. They always do get found out. But because we don't see things as they truly are, we think, oh, this is okay. Nothing wrong with this. Just a bit of fun. That's what they always say, just a bit of fun. They don't realize just how much hurt and pain is coming soon, just around the corner. Just like we used to, when the first tarmac roads were built outside our monastery in northeast Thailand. It used to be dirt roads before, but then the tarmac came. And all these like village dogs, they would go out onto that road in the evening, because during the day, the tarmac would soak up the heat. When it started getting cool in the evening, the dogs would go onto that road, and they'd lay down, it was nice and warm, it would soak up the heat, it was the warmest place. And they'd be sitting there, sort of laying down in a nice warmth, thinking, oh, what good fun this is. And they didn't realize the danger, because the trucks were coming. And they could sort of hear some sort of rumble, you know, on the sort of the ground, but it was just so nice and warm. And many, many dogs ended up as sort of squashed on the road, all their organs just splat over the tarmac, simply because they thought it was just so nice, nice and warm. They never realized the consequences of their actions. So that's what it's like sometimes, breaking that third precept, having an affair. It's just so nice, but you don't see the truck of legal bills coming, squashing your finances, and making you suffer for the rest of your life. Anyway, so sensual lust and ill will is classical denial. When you're angry, that person you're angry at, you cannot see anything nice in them at all. And of course there's many nice things in them. There's no person who's all bad. But when you're angry at them, you can't see anything nice in them. So I always say that when you really have an enemy, always know there's many people who love them, who really care for them, who think they're wonderful people. I'm just reading in the newspaper, Brian Burke is in a lot of trouble now. I'm sure there's many, many people who love that guy, who think he's such a wonderful person. How can you get angry at anybody? Sure, they do stupid, bad things. But ill will just judges them one way or the other, black and white, and never understands. So the shades of grey in every human being. That's ill will. Sloth and torpor, you're just too dull to see anything. You're just living in a haze. Restlessness, you never stay long enough on anything to really understand. You're always flitting from one thing to another. Never really spending time enough to find out. And doubt is like restlessness. With doubt, is this correct? Whatever you see, you can't think it's true, simply because it challenges you too much. Somebody once told me some time ago that when Columbus, when his ships reached, I think it was what the country now, the Dominican Republic, which, you know, he didn't actually land in the mainland of America, one in the islands in the Caribbean. But when his ships actually anchored in the bay next to this land, the indigenous people, they could, well, they should have been able to see those ships. The ships were in sight, and they weren't like tiny, they were big ships. But they couldn't see them, even though they were there. And the reason was because they'd never seen ships before, and their mind could just not comprehend what that was. So they just saw empty ocean. What is beyond your conceptual framework, you cannot see. It's amazing just how, if a spaceship landed now, many people wouldn't see it, because it can't exist. Therefore the mind blots it out. Sometimes doubt can be like that. What you think can't exist, doesn't exist. And you're not seeing things as they really are. That is what you want first has to do, to get rid of these five hindrances so what is getting real. If you're obsessed with speculation about this world, in other words, being a philosopher, then you are obsessed. And I can't remember that quote which I gave, I think, the first talk after the Range Retreat, quoting Karl Marx. It's a gross comparison, but I think it's very apt. He said, philosophy is to real life like masturbation is to sex. That's what he said. Get real. So, if Mike is absorbed about speculation about the world, then his mind is obsessed. If he's absorbed in speculation about the other world, then his mind is obsessed. That's philosophizing about what will happen after you die. If a monk takes to quarreling and brawling and is deep in disputes, stabbing others with verbal daggers, his mind is obsessed. So instead of philosophizing about this world or the next world, because do you know what's going to happen after you die? Are the Christians right and you're going to go to heaven or hell depending on whether you believe in Jesus or not? Are the Muslims right and you only go to heaven if you're a Muslim? Are the Buddhists right? How can you know? The point is that the only place you can know is in this present moment when you get into deep meditation. Then you can know for yourself which one is right. But speculation and thinking about it, that's all it is. You will never know for sure. So only the Buddhists or meditators, introspectors, only those can know for sure. You find out for yourself. But even what it says in books is so many books, you can never know what the book, whether which book is right or wrong. But certainly your own experience, when the five hindrances are gone, you can know for yourself. But also, quarreling and brawling or arguing, deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, you are not being smart, you are obsessed. So if you go home and your partner starts arguing with you and starts stabbing you with verbal daggers, you can tell them you're obsessed. Because the Buddha says that. Okay, any questions about obsessions? Yeah. Okay, it's actually asking the wrong questions about this world. Questions which not only are hard to answer, but are wasting time. It's asking the wrong question. The standard description of that is, or the metaphor, is a person who is shot with an arrow. And he says, oh, before you take the arrow out, take me to the hospital, you've got to find out who shot this arrow. And actually, what type of arrow is it? What type of wood is the shaft made of? And these feathers, that's very interesting. Are those feathers duck feathers or chicken feathers or eagle feathers? Or are they plastic feathers? And the guy who shot this, I mean, why did he do this? So instead of actually, of course, if you were shot by an arrow or by a bullet, you wouldn't be, you know, asking what type of gun shot that bullet. Was it a machine gun? Was it, I don't know, what type of guns are there? I'm not a gun expert. Whether it is a 44 or 68 or 20, I don't know. 0.22, that's a gun, isn't it? I don't know anyway. You don't care what type of gun it was. You get me to the hospital, quick. And this is the point. The speculation is a wasting time. So instead of that, just get the arrow out, first of all. The arrow is suffering. So find out what suffering is. Ask the right question, first of all. And don't speculate about questions which are interesting, but a bit of waste of time. If a person didn't have right view, could the five hindrances disappear at that point? Yes, of course. Otherwise, we all start off without right view. That's the way that right view arrives. When the five hindrances are taken away, like the mist clears, we can actually see things as they truly are. Remember, when those hindrances are disappeared, you are courageous. Because, you know, those influences of desires, what I want to see, what I don't want to see, the first two hindrances, they've gone. And you're still enough with the ending of restlessness, clear enough with the ending of sloth and torpor, and you're suspended doubt enough to actually to see clearly. So it's from the abandoning of five hindrances that you get right view. So the abandoning of the hindrances come first, right view comes afterwards. So, well, they were all, even they think they were Buddhists, but they have a bit of wrong view until the hindrances are gone. And you say, oh, this is what the Buddha meant. Now it makes sense. So that's why it has to be an experiential seeing. Just studying the texts, don't get rid of the five hindrances. So because they don't get rid of the five hindrances, it means one will still not see things as they really are. The point is we think we know, we think we see, and it all makes sense to us, but we haven't really seen properly yet. So that's why abandoning the five hindrances are most important, and then we have a chance to have right view, to see things as they truly are. And also here, he's added speculation in the same group, and also arguing in the same group. Why do we have to argue so much? I don't know, you don't know, we don't know. So let's stop arguing. Let's just get rid of the five hindrances and practice instead. So, having seen the five hindrances have disappeared and you're not arguing with anybody, you know that one of my favorite Zen stories about the two monks arguing about reincarnation. I've even seen this actually even modern times. Is reincarnation essential to right view? Can you be a Buddhist without believing in reincarnation? And these two monks were arguing, and one said, "Ah, you don't have to believe in reincarnation, you can still be a Buddhist. After all, it's all about present moment. This is the only time you can know what the truth is. And a reincarnation, that's just speculation about future lives. You can never know for sure until you're dead." And his mate said, no, if you read these suttas here, you have to believe in reincarnation. Without reincarnation, the law of karma doesn't make sense. You know, what's the point of being good? Because good people, bad people, will all die, so it's all the same in the end. Reincarnation is important. They had this argument, and they couldn't solve it. So one said, I'm going to go and see the master. He went to see the master, and he said, look, it's all about present moment. Future is uncertain, so reincarnation is not important. You don't have to believe in reincarnation to be a Buddhist. And the master heard him and said, yeah, that's right. And so he went out and told his friend, the master says, I'm right, and you're wrong. He said, can't be that. I'll go and see the master. So he went to see the master, and he said, look, it says in this sutta, in that sutta, the Buddha said about reincarnation, you remember this past lives. You know, without reincarnation, law of karma doesn't make any sense. And what's the point of getting nibbana if there's no reincarnation? And the master listened to him and said, yeah, you're right. So he went outside and said, see, the master said, I'm right, said the second monk. He couldn't have done. He said, I was right. No, he couldn't have done. He said, I was right. So I said, we'll both go and see the master. So they went in there together, and the first monk said, blah, 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 and you said I was right. And the other one said, I said this, and you said I was right. And he said, we can't both be right. And the master thought for a while and said, yeah, that's right. And that's like modern life, isn't it? Okay, so there we go. So like, being right, being wrong is not the point. He understands thus, so having you giving away all arguments and stuff, you see there's no obsession, and those obsessions are five hindrances, speculation about this world, the next world, or arguments. There is no obsession unabandoned in myself that might so obsess my mind I cannot know and see things as they truly are. My mind is well exposed for awakening to the truths. Isn't that wonderful? Well, those five hindrances are gone, and you're not speculating, and you're not arguing, then your mind is open to see well-disposed for awakening to the truths. If you're arguing, he says, you're closing the door to seeing the way things truly are. Isn't that great? All arguments miss the point. And he said, this is the first knowledge attained by him that is noble, supermundane, not shared by ordinary people. Isn't that wonderful that just saying, understanding, the mind is free from hindrances, no arguing, no speculating, is raising to that, to a huge level of being ready for awakening. So if you're having an argument with your partner, with your husband or your wife, no way can you get enlightened this evening until you settle that argument and say sorry. If you're having an argument in the office or argument in the monastery. Again, a noble disciple considers thus, when I pursue, develop and cultivate this view, do I obtain internal serenity? Do I personally obtain stillness? It's a great translation there. What do you mean by serenity and stillness? You know that when you're meditating, are you serene? In other words, nothing really disturbs you. There could be a sound, but you don't get disturbed. And inside you're just so still. The mind is stopping. It's not wandering back and forward in time. There's no thoughts pop up into the mind because you're still. You don't react to anything because it means you're serene. And even the breath gets so still it fades away. And your body is just sitting there and nothing is moving. And the mind gets so still. That's what we meditate for inner serenity and stillness of the body and the mind. That's why when you see people meditating in deep meditation, you can see they're absolutely still. Their body isn't moving at all. If you took a video of them and then put it fast forward, you wouldn't be able to tell that they were moving because they're just so still. So, does that view lead to stillness? That's a great thing to actually to ask that. That's actually almost like a definition of, you know, what is a right view, what isn't a right view. What is truth, what isn't truth? Is Buddhism right? Christianity right? Islam right? What type of Islam is right? What leads to serenity and stillness? What does lead to serenity and stillness? The Buddha is saying here, that is right view. Beautiful little saying. So, you say, those view which I have, does that lead to? When I pursue, develop and cultivate this view, do I obtain internal serenity? Do I obtain stillness? And you understand that's when I pursue, develop and cultivate this view, and I just like forgiving people, not sort of holding past bad actions of body, speech and mind of someone else. When you sort of try to fix up the faults of other people, does that lead to stillness and serenity? When you forgive them, does that lead to stillness and serenity? When you cultivate actions, kind actions of body, speech and mind, does that lead to stillness and serenity? Or you go and argue with people, does that lead to stillness and serenity? It's obvious when you ask the question. So he understands, when I pursue, develop and cultivate this view, I do obtain internal serenity. I personally obtain stillness. This is the second knowledge attained by him or her that is noble, super mundane and not shared by ordinary people. Now here we go. Again, a noble disciple considers us, is there any other recluse or Brahmin outside this Buddhist dispensation or the dispensation of the Buddha at that time possessed of such a view as I possess? He understands thus, there is no other recluse or Brahmin outside possessed of a view such as I possess. This is the third knowledge attained by him that is noble, super mundane, not shared by ordinary people. But does that mean that the Buddhism is actually special and no one outside of Buddhism will become enlightened? What is the answer to that one? It's a very famous question. Do you know who asked that question? Are there other enlightened people in religions apart from Buddhism? A very famous question asked at a very famous time. It was asked at the Parinibbana of the Buddha just before he died. Anyone know the monk's name? Or the wanderer's name, Subhadra. The last question the Buddha was asked before he passed away. Are there other enlightened beings in other religions outside of Buddhism? And what did he answer? Who knows the answer to that one? Yeah, you probably know that. Let's see if anyone else knows the answer. Anyone else know the answer to that question? Can you become enlightened in other religions? And the answer, it's a brilliant answer, was in any religion, path, philosophy, where you find the Eightfold Path, there you will find enlightened people. It's a great answer because it shows it's not the name of the religion or not the organization you belong to. It's what you do. If you put the causes in place, then enlightenment happens. So if you practice virtue, you meditate into the deep meditations, then enlightenment happens. It also answers a question which some people ask. These days, 2,500 years after the time of the Buddha, can people still become enlightened? Can lay people become enlightened? Can girls become enlightened? Can gays become enlightened? What's the answer? If they practice the Eightfold Path, of course they can. It's not who you are. It's not where you are. It's not what religion you're supposed to say you belong to. It's what you do. You put those causes in place, and then you become an enlightened person. Practice your virtue, the deep meditation, you get the wisdom, and there you are. So because you can practice the Eightfold Path these days, because gays can practice the Eightfold Path, women, men, lay people, monks, if you can practice it, then it can happen. Very clear. And makes a lot of sense. So when it says outside of this, see in the book there, the Buddha's dispensation is in brackets. It says out of this side of this Dhamma, this teaching, this practice. So it's not saying that Buddhism, actually we say what we mean by the Eightfold Path is Buddhism, but people can call themselves Christian and still be practicing Eightfold Path. This is the third knowledge obtained by him or her, that is noble, supermundane, not shared by ordinary people. Anyone have any questions about that? You are quite allowed to ask questions. Okay. Again, a noble disciple considers us. Do I possess the character of a person who possesses right view? A lot of people say they've got right view. But how can you tell they've got right view? What is their character? How do they behave? That's how you can find if a person's got right view or not. Sneak up on them. Get a private eye to take videos of them. Find out if they've got the right character or not. So what is the character of a person who possesses right view? This is the character or the nature of a person who possesses right view. Or they may commit some kind of offence for which a means of rehabilitation has been laid down, you still at once confess, reveal and disclose it to the teacher or wise companions in the holy life. And having done that, you enter upon restraint for the future. In other words, if you make a mistake, doesn't mean a person who's got right view never makes a mistake. So it's okay to make a mistake. He says, as long as you confess that mistake. And you enter upon restraint for the future. Just as a young, tender infant lying prone at once draws back when he puts his hand or foot on a live coal, so too is the character of a person who possesses right view. So if a little baby touches a hot coal, does his mum and dad beat him and say, don't do that again, this is your punishment for doing that? Of course you don't punish a kid for touching a hot coal because they don't know what they're doing, they're just learning. In the same way, he says, you shouldn't go for punishing yourself or other people. If you make a mistake, you don't punish yourself. All you do is acknowledge it, reveal it to somebody else as a way of acknowledging it to yourself, and enter upon restraint in the future. Don't do it again. That's all one needs to do. And you all should know my story of the Anagarika of my monastery many years ago. And I can't remember exactly what he did, but I think it was... He had, I think, a couple of biscuits in the afternoon. You know, in our monastery, the monastic code, even for Anagarikas, these people in white, they're not allowed to eat in the afternoon. After midday until the following morning, no solid food. But, you know, the poor young man was hungry, so he went into the kitchen when no one was looking and took some biscuits and munched them. But he felt guilty afterwards and he came to confess to me. And so, you know, follow Buddha's teaching and say, okay, you confess to me, well done, just don't do it again. You can go now. But he didn't want that. He wasn't happy just being let go. He thought, look, if you don't do something more than that, I'm going to probably do it again. I need a punishment, a penance. And that was when I decided, how can you punish a person? And obviously he was just so stubborn, he needed a really strong punishment. So I'd just been reading a book about Australian history. So it was at that time I decided to give him the punishment of 50 strokes of the cat. When I said, your punishment is 50 strokes of the cat, this poor Anagarika went more white than the clothes he was wearing. Oh my goodness, he thought, Ajahn Brahm is going to whip me. And then I told him, you all know what's going to come next. I told him what 50 strokes of the cat means in a monastery. Because in my monastery we've got three cats. Find one of them and stroke it 50 times. Learn some compassion, you hard-nosed Anagarika. Because that's what he needed to learn. He didn't need to actually have punishment. He needed how to forgive and be kind and be compassionate. So now, 50 strokes of the cat in a monastery. It doesn't mean whipping. Find a cat and stroke it 50 times to learn some kindness. So that's what we mean by not punishing. So how did I get onto that one? I forget now. Oh, the character, that's right. The character of someone who possesses right view. So you see you make a mistake and just forgive it, let it go. Just as a young tender infant lying prone at once draws back when he puts his hand or foot on live coal, so too that is the character of a person who possesses right view. Just acknowledge, but you don't hide your mistakes. Why do you want to hide your mistakes for? It's not to say, I haven't done that. You have done that. So you just let people know, take the consequences, forgive yourself, never have any guilt. And enter upon restraint in the future. Beautiful forgiveness. So if you understand, I possess the character of a person who possesses right view, it's a fourth knowledge attained by him that is noble, supermundane, not shared by ordinary people. And again, a noble disciple considers us, do I possess the character of a person who possesses right view? Same question again. What is the character of a person who possesses right view? This is the character of a person who possesses right view. This is another aspect of them. Although they may be active in various matters for his companions in the holy life, yet he has a keen regard for the training in the higher virtue, in the higher mind, and the higher wisdom. Just as a cow with a new calf, while she grazes, watches her calf, so too this is the character of a person who possesses right view. So if you have got some deep understanding of Dharma, you've got to nurture that. Just like you've got this young cow, you know, you've got some really nice ideas, you've got some insight and understanding, you've got to nurture that. And so even if you're very, very busy and do lots of things for other people, still you never neglect your training in the Dharma. So it doesn't mean you don't help out other people. A person with right view doesn't mean they don't volunteer to serve on the committee of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It means they do that, that even though you act in various matters for your companions in the holy life, you're willing to serve. You also have the keen regard for training in the higher virtue, the higher mind and the higher wisdom. The higher virtue is actually never doing anything which hurts or harms another being or hurts and harms yourself. In the higher mind, the training in the higher mind is the adi-citta. Who knows what that is? There's four of them. Come on. First jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's meditation. The higher mind is called the four jhanas. And the higher wisdom is the enlightenment wisdom. So he understands, I possess the character of a person who possesses right view. This is the fifth knowledge attained by him that is noble, supermundane, not shared by ordinary people. So even though you are busy and you do things for others, still you're always inclining to develop those three higher qualities. Yeah. That's a good question, because I may have even said that myself. based on the Mahacharitarsika Sutta. But you see in the Mahacharitarsika Sutta that they have their supposed teaching of the Buddha, which actually splits up the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path into what's supposed to be called mundane and super mundane right view. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. Yeah, it is. But okay. Yeah, there's many, many right views, and some are obviously more deep than others. And obviously the highest of the right views is probably the Four Noble Truths, but you might also say that's equivalent to seeing the three characteristics of existence. It's also equivalent to understanding dependent origination. So those are the highest right views, but these are also other right views as well, which are important. All come out of the same thing, yeah. Okay, now, again, a noble disciple asked, do I can possess the strength of a person who possesses a right view? What is the strength of a person who possesses a right view? This is the strength of a person who possesses a right view. When the Dharma discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, he heeds it, gives attention, engages with it all his mind. He hears the Dharma with eager ears and does not fall asleep. I never put that down there, but that's sort of what it also means. And that's actually a sign that, you know, you have a right view, because, you know, when you hear these really nice teachings, they just resonate. Think, wow, this is really nice, this is very good. And there's a sense of, because you've tasted the teachings before, you have some right view. Whenever you taste that delicious meal again, obviously you'll be eager to actually to go and listen to it again and again and again and again. So that's the strength of a person with the right view. When you hear these brilliant teachings, wow, this is amazing, you just can't get enough. Doesn't matter if it's gone past 4 o'clock, you are still so eager that you wouldn't even be looking at the clock, and you still want to say, wow, give me more, give me more, give me more. Because there's somebody just left a few moments ago, so they can't have a right view. Okay. And again, a noble disciple considers us, do I possess the strength of a person who possesses right view? Number two. What is the strength of a person who possesses right view? This is the strength of a person who possesses right view. When the Dharma and discipline proclaimed by the Buddha is being taught, you gain inspiration in the meaning, inspiration in the Dharma, and gladness connected with the Dharma. So that's another thing there, that when it's being taught, you get inspired and you get glad, you get happy. So this is a sign that you've seen something. Wow, this is powerful teachings. It's inspiring and it gives you happiness as well. So that's one of the reasons why people come and listen to Dhamma, because it inspires and makes them so happy. And sometimes, I hope it's happened to you, sometimes you listen to some great teachings and it inspires you sometimes so much you just cry. It's wonderful to be able to cry, get so inspired. Wow, this is brilliant stuff. And hopefully you've listened to teachings sometimes that just make so much sense, they go right to the heart, and they get an emotional response of great joy and happiness. So, then you understand, I possess the strength of a person who's possessed a right view. This is a seventh knowledge attained by him that is noble, super mundane, not shared by ordinary people. When a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven factors, he has well sought the character for realization of the fruit of stream entry. When a noble disciple is thus possessed of seven factors, he possesses the fruit of stream entry. The stream winner is one who is bound for enlightenment. So he was teaching these monks, sort of, instead of having arguments, that's an obsession, and it's going to stop you developing the path of even getting to be a stream winner. So remember the six memorable qualities in any group to have harmony and peace. And only when you have those six memorable qualities of always doing kind actions in public and in private, by body, number one, by speech, by even thought, sharing things, having common virtue and having right view, or the common view, then that creates a harmony, And then when you do go and practice and go in solitude, this is what it means by an empty place, forest, root of a tree, see if there's any obsessions in the mind. No hindrances there. No obsessions of the old argument, who said what to who and when. You know, sometimes that happens, you sit there and all you just think about is the argument you had in the office earlier today. You know, no speculation. And that means you're not obsessed by these things. And then you understand this particular view and understanding, does it lead to serenity and stillness? If it does, that's the right view. Go for that one. Whether it's the Four Noble Truths or whatever, does it work? Does it produce serenity and stillness? If it doesn't, you may have misunderstood. And then you understand that you don't have to go look anywhere else, because you know that in that this particular teaching, that's where you find enlightenment. And do you have the character of a person who possesses right view? In other words, when you make a mistake, just tell somebody and get forgiveness straight away. And do you even know that you are work for other people, and that you do a lot, but still your inclination is towards that serenity and peace? That shows you've got right view. It doesn't mean you're always just, you know, doing your own practice. Doesn't mean you're always helping others. That's what I say, the Mahayana Hinayana dichotomy is just a sham. The right way is always between that, helping others, but also inclining towards yourself, your own stillness as well. So even though, as it says here, you are active in various matters for your companions in the holy life, you have a keen regard for the training in the higher virtue, in jhanas and in wisdom. And you have the strength. In other words, that you, when you hear the Dharma being taught, you really go for it, you heed it, and it gives you joy and happiness. That shows that you're on the path of being a stream winner. And when that really grows strong, then you are the stream winner. Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean, getting strong. So the training in the jhanas, that's number, the character of a person with right view. So it leads to serenity, it leads to stillness. So if it doesn't lead to stillness and serenity, it can't be right view. And it's the stillness and serenity also create that right view. So they support each other. This is what the Blessed One said, and the monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words, which I hope you are delighted and satisfied. And if you are delighted and satisfied in that talk, then you've got a tick for one of the characters of one with right view. So, any comments or questions on the Kosambi Sutta? Great sutta, because it starts with something mundane, worldly, which you can all relate to, arguments. And how to create more harmony throughout the whole world as well. You know, even with problems with Islamic community. Wouldn't it be great if we have everybody, both the Muslims and the Buddhists and everyone else, actually maintain acts of body, speech and mind, in public and private, of loving kindness towards each other. That would solve a lot of the problems. And we share things together. And what's the other ones? That we share, and we have virtuous conduct. We don't go blowing each other up or saying terrible words about each other. And we get that right view of like peace and harmony, or like mercy in Islam. And if we do that, then we can have harmony at last. The six memorable qualities. And then we can get rid of all of our obsessions and get rid of the five hindrances. Have a view which creates stillness, not war. Not, so it doesn't make us boil. So if I ever give a talk here and then every Friday night, and people go, yeah, yeah, let's go and destroy this. Yeah, let's go. If it doesn't create stillness, it's a bad talk. So if it's right for you, it creates stillness and harmony. And then forgiveness. And what's the other ones about? Finding out if you've understood by your character and by your strengths. And then you understand the Kosambi Sutta. And then the monks won't go arguing with each other and creating all these problems ever again. Nor will anyone else have arguments. And husbands and wives will live together like milk and honey. I'm not saying which one is milk, which one is honey. Sometimes you call each other honey. Maybe you can call one another, hi, milk. Hi, honey. Okay, any other questions about this evening's or this afternoon's Kausambhya Sutta? Any other questions? Going? Well, there we go. That's it. So, has anyone got any suggestions for the next Dharma class? You have one? 38 it is. Which one's that? Don't know. It's like a Chinese restaurant. I'll order 38, 45. What is it? Craving. Mahadana Sutta. Okay. Mahatana Kaya Sutta. This is the greater discourse on the destruction of craving. Well, it's a long one, but we get through that one. Okay, the next time I'm on duty, it'll be number 38. Okay, yes, that's another possibility there, which Lynn was suggesting, that new book of mine, which I have, which is Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. There are some references in that. It's more like a technical book on meditation. And if Lynn, if you'd like to go through and get those references and make a block of them, then actually we can say that this is what we're going to be discussing next week. Okay, but the next one will be number 38. Okay, now you can pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.